much the same when we proceed in this way. If you have any questions, of course, you can ask the court about it. But I do want to make a couple of quick remarks. The only recording that is allowed is pursuant to Zoom. And you'll just want to make sure that you're following a few things. One is to keep your eye on the clock during the course of the argument. That clock should be visible to you on your screen, and the time tends to go quickly. And with that, what I'm going to do is ask the marshal to call the first case, because I see the attorneys for that case are present. I'll make a couple of more remarks, and then we'll go ahead with the arguments. So, Marshal, you can call the first case.
Now calling case A221298, Jeffrey D. Kuhn versus Richard G. Dunn et al.
And so, as I said, the rest of our proceedings go as they always have in terms of the amount of time that you have. What I'll ask the attorneys to do is, as they begin their arguments, if you will introduce yourself. We do make an audio recording of today's proceedings, and that recording is made available on our website. So it helps us to have certain things taken care of, such as introducing yourself and the client you represent before you start your remarks. And then, as I said, keep your eye on the clock. We do look forward to our conversation with you today. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Dave McLaughlin. I'm attorney in Ortonville, Minnesota, and I represent Jeffrey Kuhn, personal representative of Rory Dunn Estate. I thank the court for indulging us in this fashion. Let us use Zoom. The case is basically a rather straightforward case here. The issue is whether death constitutes a transfer by the vendee of a contract or deed, which contains basically standard language that calls for a transfer by the purchaser. And it's our position that because it called for, the contract says the purchaser would transfer, there was no action on the part of Rory Dunn, so there was no violation of the contract. This is a form contract for deed, and it has basically a form addendums to them. There's a check the box. You can assign it or you can't assign it. So there's nothing really special about this contract for deed, except that it has a prepayment clause that says that the vendee can pay $900,000, as long as he's paid $900,000 under the contract, there he can prepay it. So that's basically our position, and that's what the court needs to do. Now, the trial court said he looked at the four corners of the document and decided that the anti-assignment clause was triggered by Rory Dunn's death. Rory Dunn committed suicide and left a minor young child as his sole heir. His ex-wife, the child's mother, killed herself several months later. So basically now, The child is basically, we're trying to do is preserve the life estate equity in the property for the benefit of the child. So that's what Mr. Kuhn's basis is for this. Now, they entered into a contract for deed, and back in some time, Mr. Dunn made the payments under the contract for deed. He was current when he died, and once he died, at that point in time, shortly after that, his parents, the vendors, commenced the statutory cancellation of contract for deed. However, they didn't follow the statute precisely because they specifically said the conditions for cure under the statutory scheme, those didn't apply because they would not accept any payments whatsoever. The only thing we could do is give the property back. And the trust
counsel, if I could, before we get into any right to cure or that portion of your argument, which I have read, I'd like to go back a moment to talk about this anti-transfer provision in the contract for deed. And I appreciate that this is case comes. You know, we're talking about a lot of legal things, but there's been a great tragedy for the family. And I recognize that. But we are asked, you're asking this court, and the district court was asked to interpret this contract for deed and the anti-transfer clause. And as you know, we do that as a matter of law. Minnesota has shown great respect for anti-transfer provisions and contracts of all sorts, including contracts for deed. And like you said, this is pretty much a form anti-transfer clause. So you explained that this is an intestate transfer, but what if our purchaser, Rory, the son, what if he had written a will and had or created a trust and passed this property or his rights under the contract for deed to a son in that way? The triggering event, under a will, still would have been Rory's death. So would that sort of transfer have violated the anti-transfer clause in this contract for deed?
We don't believe so, but in this case, that's not the facts of the situation. There wasn't.
And I know it's not the facts, but we have to think about these things. And you probably appreciate that I'm alluding to the Woodard case, which looked at a transfer and death deed. Before I talk about Woodard, I want to make sure you pause and explain to me why, because that's still an involuntary act, right? At least the death part, which is what you're emphasizing for the transfer to the son in this case, the minor child, that death is, yeah, that's involuntary. Okay. You know, as far as with the triggering event for the transfer, but there are other acts mm-hmm. you know, that are voluntary.
And basically what the position we take is that the Vendee, this is basically a financing agreement. The Vendee promises to pay such and such a money, he gets the property back. You look at any contract for deed, and if you follow the court's ruling, if we would have made the payments for 20 years on this contract for deed, one payment left, if they could cancel the contract for deed, they'd keep the land back, keep all the money that we paid them, and we would have nothing. So if, for example, you were buying a house on a contract for deed and you made those payments and one of the vendees died, you'd lose every dime that you put into that property, plus any appreciation that's there. And if you look at that from that perspective, the court shouldn't accept that as a public policy of saying you enter into a contract for deed, you die, it's gone. So if it's a will, it should still not cover that part of it. The transfer on death deed was different. And even the people that represented the vendor in that case said, you know, hey, this is a problem with contract for deeds. How are you going to deal with this in the future? And if you look at the ordinary practitioners, how are they supposed to deal with this issue then going forward? The one answer is obviously you don't use contract for deeds, because if it's a mortgage, it's okay.
Except you're right, that's a practical solution, not to use the contract for deed. But that we've got one here, and they are pretty common. And whatever this court says in this case is likely to have some influence in terms of how, even if we issue a non-precedential opinion, as we saw in the Woodard case, right, has some influence. Right. So help me out. What are you suggesting, that if it was a transfer by will, it would or would not violate this antitrust?
It would not be a violation of the transfer on death deed, because that's not what the parties contemplated when anytime you enter these agreements.
Why is it not what the parties contemplated?
Because you don't, when you deal with these contract for deeds and you're explaining it to your client and you're saying, okay, you entered this contract for deed, and if you die, you lose everything. How you're supposed to be explained a contract for deed? Because that is a result of the case. If the court follows Woodard and the rest of that same logic, you can't use a contract for deed because the buyer is totally at risk all the way through it.
Mr. McLaughlin, it seems that that's a bit of an overstatement, because you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the sellers could have agreed to, let's assume there was a transfer on death deed here, and we know Woodard would be then applicable in all fours, even under your own argument, right? In that case, if there was a transfer on death deed executed, but the sellers agreed to it, right? Wouldn't that be permissible? And so maybe what you're telling your clients is these are the kinds of things that could constitute a transfer, voluntary, involuntary. So, you know, to be completely responsible and careful or whatever, you want to make sure that you know whether the purchaser has a will and that you've looked at it and you've agreed to it if you're the seller, or you know if the purchaser has any intent to execute a transfer on death deed and you've talked about it with them. Isn't that the more practical solution, even assuming that you have that conversation with your client about what constitutes a transfer?
It's not, Your Honor, because what you're dealing with is something that happens at the end. You end up where the parties begin, they say, this is a contract deed, everything is going to be good. All of a sudden, 20 years have went by, all the payments have been made. The vendor says, I can get all the property back and keep all the money. Why wouldn't I do that? And that's exactly what you let the vendors do if that's the case, because the vendors aren't going to agree. What do you do if they don't agree? Then it's just gone, right?
Well, it seems that that's part of the nature of a contract for deed, is that there is some risk that either because you won't be able to make payments, you're making some assumptions about financial ability as a purchaser into the future to make payments, and you know if there is if you're unable to, maybe you can cure it, maybe you can't, but there is some risk there. That, and that argument seems to really just be more about the nature of the risk rather than public policy, you know, as to what transfer means. And we haven't even gotten into the difference between what the parties intended and what is written in the contract. So I didn't see any argument that this was an ambiguous provision, right?
Correct, Your Honor. We believe what the contract says is the purchaser, meaning Rory Dunn, had to make an affirmative act, and he didn't make an affirmative act, he died. So based on that, there is no violation of that specific language. If they wanted some other term, they would have said any transfer, not a transfer by the purchaser. So that's basically why it is not a violation of it, if you go by that the contract. And that's a form contract that's in every contract for deed.
So, counsel, if I could just ask a quick follow-up. You're suggesting that if the CD had been written, the anti-transfer clause, to prohibit any transfer, so something like no transfer of any sort, or no sale, conveyance, or otherwise transfer of this property will be allowed, something like that. Yeah. So I guess what I'm struggling with is who else would do the transfer if it's not the purchaser, right? I mean, I appreciate the fact that you've argued, and very eloquently, by the way, that the use of this noun purchaser suggests that Rory had to take an affirmative act, right? But the contract doesn't interject that affirmative or voluntary part. I mean, that's your interpretation based on the use of the noun purchaser. And I'm wondering whether that's a valid, you know, a caveat on the clause, given that who else is going to do it? I mean, it has to be the purchaser. The purchaser has the equitable rights based on the contract for deed. So help me understand that. Why we would say that this clause is not effective to prohibit this type of transfer, but a clause that said any transfer is what's required.
The basic reason is because what this results is a forfeiture of all of the equity, all of the payments under the contract for deed that were made. That's the problem with this situation.
Right. But Mr. McLaughlin, I think the question, as I understood it, is from Judge Bradfield, is what other kind of, we'll call them involuntary acts, or what other people, nouns, subjects, can act in a way that could transfer the equitable rights that the purchaser has? So apart from our situation, what other time would you have an involuntary transfer?
Let's say I have a judgment debt creditor. The judgment creditor executes on the property. That we didn't do anything. The court, I mean, the sheriff's had a sheriff's sale. executed the property, and that was gone. The vendee did nothing. That transaction would be covered, and that would be meets your condition. A mortgage foreclosure could do the same thing. You know, it's basically what this holding would do is would set things up to avoid fraudulent conveyances. Debtors could use this process to actually do fraudulent conveyances. This is a transfer to a family member. We create a default, and the property would be transferred back. There's nothing that the creditors or anything else could do about it. All the equity would be gone. And that's probably not what the court intends to do either. So my judgment creditor, for example, that would be a violation. And the judgment creditor says, vendor, here's all your money. And the vendor says, no, I won't take the money. I want the property back. And that's it. That's what you're creating when you do this, if the court adopts that position.
Mr. McLaughlin, it seems your argument depends heavily on the distinction between a voluntary act and an involuntary act. Am I correct in that? Isn't a person's decision to not make a will, in a sense, a voluntary act, and therefore, you know, thereby shouldn't we impute to people such as the deceased that, you know, he was aware that upon his death the probate code would have this automatic by operation of law would transfer his interest to his son. Isn't that within the concept of a voluntary act?
It should take an affirmative act on the part of Rory Dunn, the vendee, to trigger the anti-assignment clause. That's basically all of the case law talks about that with the anti-assignment clause. You're supposed to stop at this. We have to be able to do something, right? Otherwise, what the court is saying is that always contractor deeds, vendors can always take the money back. To take the property back, keep the money. And anybody who would do that under that scenario would be a fool, because they're going to take a good chance of losing all their money. And so you shouldn't use a contract for deed. That's what the court would be saying if that were the result. And I don't know what we do with the hundreds of thousands of ones that are already out.
Mr. McLaughlin, I'll just point out that your 15 minutes has expired. Now, of course, as appellant, you have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal if you choose.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
So I think we're ready for counsel for respondent when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Alex Masteller, and I represent the respondents Richard and Paulette Dunn in this matter. It's our position that the issues and the arguments have been fully briefed, and so I welcome your questions. Any prepared remarks that I have will be concise. I think it's actually probably most efficient if I go off script right away and just address the question that Mr. McLaughlin has been asked. One thing I think is worth clarifying is that the anti-transfer provision is not in every contract for deed. This is a specific election to have an addendum to the contract for deed. And these forms, they are forms. They're published, they're uniform conveyancing blanks, approved by the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And the parties had to specifically elect for this anti-transfer provision to be a part of the contract. And even within the anti-transfer provision, there's a more restrictive and less restrictive choice. And in this provision, the parties elected to select the more restrictive choice, which states that the consent for a transfer shall be granted or withheld in the sole discretion of the seller. And the anti-transfer provision includes a catch-all term that says, or otherwise transfer. And the purpose of that is to include any type of transfer of any kind so that the seller, Richard and Paulette, wouldn't have to be in privity of contract with someone they didn't choose to be in privity of contract with. They could have permitted in their sole discretion a transfer. The parties could have decided not to include the transfer restriction. They could have included the lesser restrictive transfer restriction, which says shall not be unreasonably withheld or delayed by seller. Those are options that the parties could have selected. So this is not a contract for deed on a greater scale problem. This is the terms that the parties themselves chose.
And Mr. Masteller, so, and looking at the language of the provision, it says purchaser may not sell, assign, or otherwise transfer purchaser's interest, dot, dot, dot. It wouldn't the average person believe upon reading that, that those are things that the purchaser may not do, and that means the what the purchaser may not do during his or her lifetime, while they're alive, while they're able to do anything, to take actions. But that would be that the provision is not triggered unless the purchaser takes one of those actions during his or her lifetime. And wouldn't that be the natural interpretation by somebody reading that at the time of entering into the contract for deed?
Sure. I understand. I understand that question. And I think it needs to be read together with the consent from the seller. And so the entire provision means that the purchaser they have to continue. They own the property until the seller consents to them transferring the property. And if it leaves their possession, then the seller has the right to consent to it or not to consent to it. And so if it leaves their possession, that is what triggers the event. And again, we can discuss Woodard. That is what the court held there, is that the transfer occurred on the death. The transfer on death deed simply directed where the transfer would go. But the transfer itself, in that case, was also involuntary, as we've discussed, as the term voluntary or involuntary.
Mr. Mastella, do you make a distinction between somebody who affirmatively or takes an act such as executing a transfer on death deed and someone who does nothing?
From our position, whether it is a will, whether it's a transfer on death deed, or whether it's the laws of intestacy, all of those things, if they're not consented to, would result in a transfer that would be considered.
I guess I'm asking you to look at the nature of those decisions. A decision to execute a transfer on death deed requires, presumably it requires a signature. The act of signing that to make that TOD effective requires something more, wouldn't it, than doing nothing?
Signing a TOD simply directs who would get the property. It doesn't transfer the property. And subjecting yourself to the laws of intestacy, the state has determined who would get your property. And so it's essentially a way to get around the intestacies and avoid probate. But I do see what you're saying, in that it is a more affirmative act on who gets the property, but it is only effective upon the death.
Can I, Mr. Mastella, I mean, one way to look at this issue is, I mean, looking at the agreement, it appears that neither party maybe contemplated what occurred, the early death of the purchaser, and therefore neither party inserted any language into the contract that would have made some express provision for what happens if the purchaser dies before the contract is paid off. So, I mean, one way to look at this problem is, you know, who should bear the risk of that particular situation? Because it seems like, I mean, all the arguments that you're making, that the purchaser, could have negotiated something different. I mean, the same is true for the seller. The seller could have included a term that would have, you know, expressly provided for the the forfeiture of the interest, or that the interest, the fee would have reverted back to the sellers upon the death, and so on. So, excuse me. I guess, do you have any comments on that way of looking at it? Is that a valid part of our analysis?
Sure. From the seller's perspective, the seller's perspective was, while the terms of the contract for deed are ongoing, they were in privity of contract, in this case, with their son. And they needed to consent to be in privity of contract with anyone else. And while it doesn't expressly state what happens if a party dies, it provides them with the discretion to consent to a transfer. And again, it is a form contract with a transfer restriction that is form. And there is the catch-all phrase, or otherwise transfer. The seller's position is, if the party on the other side of the table is going to be someone different than who we enter into this contract with, we want to have a say in that. And the reasons for that, again, is not terribly relevant within the four corners of the document, but this is in fact a farm that the sellers owned, and they inserted this provision with intention, so that they could control the property until it was no longer in their control.
I'd like to add, go ahead, Judge Johnson, if you have a follow-up. I was going to change topics here, but if you want to keep going, please. Okay, I'm wondering if there, to change gears a little bit here, the peculiar posture of this case is something I'd like you to address as well. So as I understand it, there was a motion for temporary injunctive relief. No answer had been filed. And at that point, the district court judge, sua sponte, dismisses the claim for a permanent injunction. So what authority does a district court judge have to dismiss a claim when there has been no answer? So pleadings aren't closed yet. Sua sponte, without a motion of the parties, without notice. And you know, if you look at 5606, if the court's going to grant summary judgment sua sponte, there's a requirement in there. So what authority is there for a district court to do as the district court did here, granting essentially a motion to dismiss prior to an answer being filed sua sponte?
Your Honor, the district court treated the case as a summary judgment motion in the very first hearing, and determined that the likelihood of success on the merits for the injunction was not proper, and did on its own merits transform this into a summary judgment motion and granted judgment accordingly. I believe that.
Well, we have case law that if a district court wants to do that, they have to follow the rule requiring notice and opportunity to brief it. And if they don't, then we reverse that summary judgment decision, even if it's a legal matter. So how does the district court get around the requirements of 5606 here?
Your Honor, that is a good question. And that is not a question that appellants raised. And so I believe the judge analyzed what the case before him and made a dismissal as a matter of law.
Let me follow up too, because as I look at this, the parties both developed an interpretation of this clause that's at odds with each other. And to support that, they're looking to things like public policy, things like intent of the parties and the intent of the sellers to keep the family farm, you know, intact. And as you noted, when it's a four corners decision, we don't look at that. But what would happen if we looked at this contractual language and decided it's ambiguous. It might mean that there has to be an affirmative act, or maybe it doesn't. And if in that case, I assume you'd agree that there would be some need for discovery and facts regarding intent of the parties and whatnot. And that was neither party had a chance to develop that because of the way the district court proceeded.
Your Honor, the four corners of the document are what the judge ultimately ruled on, and that the judge stated as such, that they didn't use any parole evidence, determined it was an unambiguous contract. Unfortunately, with the contract being presented, I don't know that there would be any testimony that would be able to be developed, because I think if my client were to testify to the contract, there would be an objection saying that the contract language states what it states, and it is unambiguous. The judge stated in the district court that they did not use parole evidence and just used the terms of the unambiguous contract, and that issue was not raised on appeal.
Mr. Masteller, if the young child of Rory inherits this interest, thereafter, would the anti-transfer provision be binding on him or his representative?
I think that's a good question, because it would have already been transferred to a different party, and therefore, I guess that is a very good question. If that were the case, we would strongly believe so. But the facts of this case are very sad, and we are trying to keep it to a contractual analysis.
Counsel, if I can just, I see your time is almost up. There is a provision in this contract for deed that relates to successors and interests, and that this is a term that the terms run with the land, right? So I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. You take whatever position you want, but I just want to make sure you think about it in terms of answering the question.
No, I understand that. And it does say that. And that successor and interest language, part of that was raised by Mr. McLaughlin as why this shouldn't be applicable. My client could transfer the property. There was no prohibition on this, on the seller transferring the property. And regarding that term, and the appellant's argument, in the contract for deed addendum, it does say that the terms and conditions contained in the addendum supersede any conflicting provisions contained in this contract. And so our position would be that the anti-transfer provision controls.
Judge Bradfield, I had a follow-up question. May I ask it beyond the time?
Yes, please go ahead.
Mr. Masteller, and again, assuming for the moment that the young child inherits the interest, is there anything that would prohibit negotiations about perhaps reforming the contract in various ways? For example, by providing some forbearance on payments until a later date, a later year, are the parties locked into an agreement where payments must be made, or could that be renegotiated?
I think if that were the case, I think the parties could always negotiate an agreement. What we've been provided in this matter is that if the child and his personal representative get the property, their intention is to sell it, which is exactly the opposite of what Richard and Paulette ever had in mind.
So if I, Judge Breffel, may I jump into, as we noted, if the contract has a provision regarding successors, the heir is the successor and now has the equitable interest that the purchaser used to have, and the anti-transfer clause, so wouldn't that also preclude the successor in interest from doing as you suggest?
That would preclude the successor in interest from doing as we suggest, while the terms of the contract for deed are applicable, if that's the case. But again, our position is that the anti-transfer provision supersedes any term that would conflict in the standard contract for deed form.
Anything further from the panel? All right. Thank you, Mr. Masteller. So with that, I see that the clock has changed and we have 5 minutes for rebuttal for you, Mr. McLaughlin, if you choose. You can begin when you're ready. So I'm not able to hear you right now, Mr. McLaughlin.
Yes, I'm sorry. I did not
unmute. Yeah.
The court obviously understands the issues, is contemplating the issues. The only issue that we would want to add is that the contract for deed provides for a payout of if they paid $900,000, we get the deed. So the statement that it's supposed to keep it in the farm and all family and all the rest of the stuff, that is not the case, because if you can construe those two together, we could have paid the contract off. And when they canceled the contract, they specifically refused to take any money whatsoever. It was give us the property back, we're keeping it, and that's the end of it. So basically, that's why we're in the position we're in today.
Mr. McLaughlin, do you have any position or views as to whether the anti-transfer restriction would continue to apply and would bind the young child of Rory if he were to inherit?
Yes, we believe it would still be in effect. So the trust, if Jeff Kuhn were to decide to sell the property, he'd have to get consent or anything else by the terms of the contract, or pay him off, because he can pay him off $900,000 under the contract and then it's over. So those things are available. It's the vendors refuse to do anything with the contract. They just wanted the farm back so they can do something else with it and keep the money that was paid. And that is overreaching in our positions, in our minds. So otherwise I have nothing to add if there's no other questions. So.
Is there anything from the panel? And feel free to take a few moments if you like. I guess I will have one question for you, Mr. McLaughlin. I'm sure you were paying attention to Judge Bryan's questions about the procedural posture of this case, because it is unusual. And Respondents' Counsel certainly made a valid point that it's not a problem that you've raised in your brief in terms of the district court's decision to go ahead and dismiss your action in full following a denial of the temporary injunction. Nor most cases we would see additional proceedings after that before a full dismissal. So would you comment on that and whether, you know, well, I'll just stop there.
We believe that we raised that with the court, and we raised it in our appeal brief. We said that the court entered the judgment, and basically we didn't get to do discovery. We didn't do any of the other issues. The issues weren't developed. The court made its ruling. We asked for a new trial, change of those things. The court refused. So the trial court had made up its decision, and that was the end of it. We believe we raised that issue in front of this court by just the statements in the brief itself.
Well, help me out then. What are you asking us? Because I understood that you were looking for us to simply to reverse and remand so that judgment would be entered in your favor as a matter of law. Are you asking for something else? I mean, yes. I know you had a motion for new trial. I'm aware of that. But as the district court said, this isn't a case that was tried and the parties weren't asking for a trial. You were asking for a straight up interpretation of the contract.
Right.
Help me understand what you want.
Yeah. Yes, We would like it reversed, but we have nothing else. We should have a trial to develop the evidence behind it, because basically, if the court only looked at the contract, all of this stuff regarding keeping it in the family and other things like that, which the trial court specifically mentions, would not be there. So we believe that this court, we would want the court to reverse the decision that death isn't a transfer, but we would also, if that isn't the time because of evidence isn't developed sufficiently, we would take it, you know, we believe, yes, it should be remanded to have a hearing on, evidentiary hearing on the matter.
So it sounds like in the alternative, at least in this argument, you're suggesting that if we determine the contract's ambiguous, you're asking for a remand. Because I guess I'm struggling to understand what sort of trial you would have unless the contract's ambiguous, right?
Yes.
So you're saying maybe it is the contract, I mean.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, if I may, I think that's a little bit different than a challenge to the district court's authority to do what it did here. Or a challenge to not giving adequate opportunity to, let's say, brief what does Woodard mean, and to look at what other states, it's a uniform, maybe there are other states that have a similar issue. And if you don't have an opportunity to do that briefing to the district court, I think if it is a Rule 56.06 process, then there might be a challenge on that basis. That's separate from saying, in the alternative, it's ambiguous, and therefore there's a fact issue, and we need discovery. So I want to make it very clear. Are you, in your briefs, you think that you have raised both issues, or just the ambiguity issue, or just the procedural issue?
We believe we raised both issues. We could have done it more artfully on the procedure the court followed, but we believe we raised both issues.
Is there anything further from the panel? Judge Brian? No? Okay. All right. Thank you so much, counsel. Really appreciate your arguments today and the briefing. This is a very interesting case. As I said at the beginning, we recognize also a deep family tragedy, but we appreciate the question of law that has been presented to us and perhaps other questions as we've discussed during the course of the argument. And with that, I want the parties to understand that this matter is now submitted to the court for a decision.